Today is Thursday, September 28, 2023. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Okay.
Great. Peter, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you so much. In part two, you had mentioned working on your master's thesis, mapping the geology of the Deer Creek and Tepetz Creek drainages, and you and your wife had rented a small little cabin up on the rim there. And this, you're doing your master's, and that's going to turn into your PhD, I think, at the University of Arizona. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Peter, how did you fund that? How did you manage your groceries and your rental apartment costs and gasoline and everything else?
Well, okay. In terms of the master's thesis and the PhD at the University of Arizona, the primary support I had was a National Defense Education Act fellowship that was awarded to the department. And that was a program that Lyndon Johnson sponsored to enhance science preparation across the country after Sputnik.
Okay.
So that was the primary. The secondary was I earned a little money buying and selling old U.S. currency to numismatists. And then the thesis itself was partially supported by a summer grant from the Museum of Northern Arizona.
Okay, I want to open those up one by one, if you don't mind. So the National Defense Fellowship, can you tell me about that?
Well, that was a special congressionally authorized program that they were... They were funding sciences of all types across the country to bring us up to speed against what we perceived as a Russian edge in science.
Okay.
So they were funding all kinds of it. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time to get one of these things. They were absolutely marvelous. They could run for 3 years to get you from a master's to a PhD.
Okay.
And I think the total stipend for the student was like $2,900 a year, which doesn't sound like much today, but that went a long way back then.
It did. Wow.
And
okay.
The college that sponsored the candidate got a share, a matching share to that. So they had a terrific incentive to get involved in these things.
Oh, wow.
And the fellow that lined that up for me was the head of the hydrology program, John Harshbarger.
Can we stop for a minute, and can you tell me what you remember about John?
Well, he was a very imposing figure in geology and hydrology. I knew him later in his life. He used to work for the USGS, and he was very active on the Colorado Plateau back in the 50s and 60s.
In what way?
Well, they were mapping all the stratigraphy from in northern Arizona to southwestern Utah, and it was reconnaissance stuff. And in those days, all that country was accessible only by dirt roads.
Okay.
So they were in there very early. As he started working through his career, he got progressively more into water, particularly groundwater. And ultimately, he moved on to the University of Arizona and in time became chair of their hydrogeology program. And that's where I came in. He was a few years into that hydrogeology program when I joined the program as a grad student back in, it would have been 63 or something like that. Yeah, 63 I went down there.
Okay.
As an undergraduate. So I got all 3 degrees in that program, and he served as my primary advisor.
All right. What do you remember about him as a person?
Well, he was a very active, and he also operated a consulting firm. And that firm hired several graduate students that he had.
Okay.
I actually never worked for the firm. Since I had that fellowship, I didn't need that type of support.
Got it.
But anyway, he had an international reputation. At the time, he was having some health issues. He had very severe arthritis.
Oh.
And what he did is he got involved in at the university about the time that hit. And what I recall was that he told me one time that when he first contracted it, he could hardly move. And there was an older gentleman that was a structural geologist, a guy named Evans B. Mayo. And Mayo was in the department. And what he used to do is Mayo would go out and do field work in the Tucson Mountains, and Harshbarger would ride along with him and simply sit in the car while Mayo was out in the field, and he was soaking up the sun and the heat, and it really did a marvelous job bringing him around. It took him a couple of years,
nice.
And then he was off. But he was full of energy, and he launched this hydrology program down there. He was very prescient in seeing that was going to be a big thing in Arizona. And what he was mostly interested in was groundwater exploration and groundwater development, more so than any surface water considerations. And that made Arizona almost unique at the time. They had within a couple of years, they had the strongest groundwater program in the country. And they hired appropriately. They got a number of really good people in there.
Wow.
And launched that program.
Okay. And I'm looking at the numbers here. I'm assuming that when you got the fellowship, that paid for your tuition. Because
Oh yeah, it paid for everything.
When I went to the U of A in the 1970s, the tuition was certainly manageable. A grant like that would have been stunning, a fellowship like that. So I can see where it would have been really lucrative to the university and the student.
Yeah, it was a real good deal. I simply didn't have to do any other work at the time.
Nice. Moving on here, you mentioned the numismatist. Can you open that up a little bit? When did you get interested in coins and bill collecting?
Well, I never had any interest really in coins per se. It turned out that my grandfather was a stamp dealer in New York City back in the 20s and the 30s, and he came to live with us when I was still living in New Jersey with my mother, and so I was interested in, I got interested in stamps. Well, what I was really interested in was the products of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which was engraved products. So by the time I got to junior high school, I had sort of a tentative interest in currency, and I used to watch the silver certificates go by that we were spending at the time, and I started collecting them by the treasury signatures that were on them. And I did that in junior high school.
So wait. I'm sorry. You're opening up something here, which I'm full of questions about. What's a silver certificate?
Well, today our currency consists of Federal Reserve notes.
Yep.
And those are issued by the Federal Reserve banks, and so that's what you use. But back then they used to have silver certificates. And these silver certificates were redeemable in silver dollars. So you got a $1 bill, and it would allow you to get a dollar's worth of silver from the treasury. And so that's how they used to back the currency.
If I had a silver certificate and I went to the bank, I would give them the certificate. They would then give me a silver dollar or 4 quarters in silver. And then would they cancel the certificate?
Well, they wouldn't, but the Treasury would keep track of that kind of thing. And if there was a lot of silver dollars out, then they would redeem an equal amount of these silver certificates. Because what the silver certificate was simply a promise to pay a dollar in silver. So once it was given out, then they would have to redeem a note against it.
Well, how would you collect those? I mean, were you collecting ones that were actual valid silver certificates?
You're
trying to get the different names on the different certificates. You got 10 of those certificates. That's $10 in silver. We're starting to talk about real money here for a junior high kid.
It starts to add up. But fortunately, they were only changing the signatures on them every few years. So a total collection for about 20 years consisted of about 13 notes. So it wasn't a big problem. But anyway, I started to collect these things. Huh. Well, once I started to collect them, then I realized that there were collectors of these things, and it didn't take it long at all to plug into that network. And then I started to get very serious about that. But my interest in this stuff germinated, like I say, in junior high or high school. But I didn't get very active in it until 1963. In 1963, I was an undergraduate at the University of Arizona. And then the Federal Reserve Bank started issuing $1 bills. And as soon as they started issuing $1 bills, then I tried to collect one from each of the 12 Federal Reserve districts. And that just, all of a sudden, the thing exploded. But by then, I had I had a meager budget. I could put a couple $100 into this stuff. And one of the things I did at that time in 1963, 4 and 5, like that, I developed a circuit where I would go to the different banks on Friday afternoons after class and ask the tellers if they got anything unusual in over the counter in a way of currency. And, of course, people spend their money, and some of the stuff they spend is old, and once in a while, one of these tellers would come up with a big hit with something really old, and I'd buy it from them.
Like what? Can you give me an example?
Well, there's a couple of things. For example, back before 1935, all the national banks in the country could issue currency with their name printed on it.
Oh, wow.
And that was, this was a Civil War program to increase the money supply and help fund the Civil War. They had national banks that issued money. That was the origin of the national banking system.
Okay.
Anyway, by 1928, they started reducing the size of the currency. The currency used to be a lot bigger than it is today, and you had to have a bigger wallet. Anyway, they reduced the size of it, and they had small-size national bank notes. And they lasted from 1929 to 1935, and then they were phased out. But once in a while, one of those would come into a bank, and the tellers would, after they got to know me, they would save them, and if I came in, I could buy them from them.
And would you buy them for the face value?
Well, I'd pay them whatever they wanted for them. If they were valuable, I'd pay them what they were worth. At the time, that stuff wasn't too expensive. There weren't a lot of people in the country that were collecting it, so I could get this stuff reasonably. And then I traded it, or I would sell it to people. And by the time I got to graduate school, I had a very modest little mail order business buying and selling this stuff.
Wow.
And, of course, by then, I would buy it from other collectors as well as bank tellers. You know, I'd get it wherever I could. And if I didn't want to keep it, I would market it. And that increased my earnings by maybe, I don't know, $1,000 a year or something like that. But
wow.
It paid off, and it was fun.
Huh. You mentioned that the size of the currency notes decreased around 1928. Would the bank tellers get one of these older, larger bills in on occasion?
Well, that would happen. That would happen once in a while. I didn't see very many of those come in at all.
Okay.
But they did, and once in a while, you get a old $20 Federal Reserve note or something like that that was a large size. They were pretty nice looking notes.
Huh.
Of course, usually if they came into a bank, they were pretty used.
Beat up. Yeah, yeah.
But you never knew what was going to turn up. The other thing I would pick up once in a while, this was a lot of fun, was some misprint that would come through in the new money. You know, a corner folded over with a seal on the back or something like that. That would be a lot of fun.
And were you asking the bank tellers to keep an eye out for those misprints?
Yeah, I'd just ask them for anything unusual. And I had about maybe three or four tellers around the town that would actively put them away. What they would do, they'd get something unusual in, and they'd just put it at the bottom of that denomination's drawer in their teller cage. And when I showed up, they'd pull out the bottom note, and there would be something interesting.
Wow. And would you do that like once a week, make your circuit?
Yeah, I did that. I did that on Friday afternoons. I kind of jokingly say that was the one. Instead of going out with the guys for a beer, I went around on my little circuit to these banks.
Oh, my gosh. And visit with the tellers.
Yeah. And I they got to know me after a while. And it was just a fun way to let off steam at the end of the week and mm-hmm. do something different.
And it must have been fun. Do you think it was fun for them? Because, you can only count out so much money in a bank, and pretty soon it gets kind of boring. But I would assume to actually have to look at what you're doing, to think about some young man who's going to come in and inquire about the odd things you see in your job, that's kind of neat.
Yeah. There was one guy down at the South Tucson branch, a guy named Serino Scavone, and I walked into that bank one day, cold, and I walked through the door, and there's a line of tellers, and he was the guy straight ahead of me. So, of course, I went right to him, and I walked up to the teller cage, and I said, "Hey, I got a strange request. Do you have any unusual money that comes in? I'm interested in it." And the guy looked at me, and he said, the first thing out of his mouth is he said, "I have been waiting for you to walk in here for years."
Whoa!
And that's just what I wanted to hear, because he was seeing stuff go by, and he had no, he didn't have a lot of money. He couldn't take it home. So it was going by, and he was just hoping somebody would take an interest in it.
How cool is that?
Yeah, he became a very close friend, and he got all kinds of stuff over the years.
Wow.
And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
He careered as a bank teller.
Yeah, and then he rose in the bank, and he moved around the state, and everywhere he went, he bird-dogged his stuff and would let me know about it.
Wow. How many?
One of the most interesting things that he walked into is he was an auditor.
Okay.
And he went down to, he was in the Valley National Bank, so of course they were all over the state.
Yeah.
He went down to Douglas to audit. And he went in the office, the manager's office, and the guy had a frame on the wall with a large $10 bill in it, So Serena walked over there to see what the large note was. And what it was a national bank note that was issued by the First National Bank at Douglas.
Wow.
And the beauty of this thing was it said Territory of Arizona on it.
Ooh.
And there it was hanging on the guy's wall.
Wow.
Well, he called me up and said, "Hey, this guy's got this thing down there." And I thought, wow, that's worth a trip down there. So I drove down there to see the guy, and I had terrific luck. The guy had gotten a promotion and was moving out of the bank, and his grip wasn't very tight, and he sold the thing to me.
Wow.
things like that happen.
What did you buy it for?
I have no idea.
Okay. I mean,
it probably would have been a $1,000 or $1,500 at the time.
Oh, like wow.
That.
I mean, that's huge. This is a $10 bill. For it to go for $1,000, that's, wow.
Well, some of the stuff got real good after a while.
Wow. And this was when you were a teenager.
Well, no, I was in my 20s when this was going on.
Oh, okay.
This would have been, after 1963.
Okay. But in your 20s, you were sharp enough to know I should pay $1,000 in 1963 money to buy this $10 bill.
Yeah, I knew the market by then, you know. And I kept that up. I've kept that up most of my life.
Wow. Okay. That's just amazing. How many people do you think were buying and selling and interested in currency in the 60s when you were doing this?
Well, the total number would be in several thousands. And the people that were really into these national banknotes would have been into the several hundreds. And, of course, that's grown like topsy since those days.
Okay.
Now there's a huge market in it. I mean, this is a multi-million dollar market now.
Okay. Huh. And I want to add that having gone to College Park, Maryland, to look at the National Archives there and talking to the people that work there, I was working on a Grand Canyon project, and they said, oh, Grand Canyon, do you know Peter Hantoon? And your reputation had preceded you there, and I said, yeah, I know of Peter. I couldn't recognize him in a lineup, but I know of him. And said, oh, he is one of, or the only person who has the ability to walk through our archives as a numismatist. How did you work that out with the National Archives? How did that all develop?
Well, that started when I was a college student. I was when I was active in Tucson, I used to go to a coin shop on East Broadway, and it was called the Glass Shop Coins. And it was owned by a guy named Hal Burt. And Hal was a very advanced numismatist. And he specialized in tokens that were made by bars and things like that with the name of the town on them.
Huh.
And he specialized in Arizona tokens and Arizona script that would be given away by firms that was good for money if you came back and bought merchandise and that kind of stuff. So it was similar to national banknotes in that it had this local appeal. And anyway, I used to go in, and we had great discussions, and he would occasionally buy something very good and sell it to me.
Oh, wow.
Well, anyway, in the course of this, Hal authored catalogs on these tokens and also on script. And so he was kind of a writer that was well-known for Arizona. And as he started seeing me mature a little bit, he suggested that I ought to write some of the stuff up that I was seeing. So I did, and it turned out that it was a very good mentor relationship. I wrote up a couple of articles for some coin publications about error notes or things like that that I got, and that got me into writing. Well, I've been writing ever since. So the idea is I always credit him with kind of helping me launch this writing sideline that I have.
Nice.
And now I write a couple of columns, and I get out about 20-some articles a year and this stuff. But what happened was that very early on, I plugged into that group of numismatists, the guys that were writing about paper money, and I got introduced to the fact that the records for this stuff was in the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. Now, it used to be downtown in Washington, D.C., and I'd go there and I'd work these records. So that's where these people knew me from.
So tell me about your first. Let's head down this tangent, if you're okay with this. Tell me about your first visit to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Do you remember roughly what year that was?
Well, the place that I went was the Civil Documents Division, and what they had was a lot of treasury records that were turned over to them.
Okay.
And the ones that I was interested in were the records of the Comptroller of the Currency. The Comptroller of the Currency is the office that handled the issuance of these national banknotes.
Okay.
From 1863 to, it still operates. Today they do Federal Reserve notes and things like that. But at any rate, the Comptroller's office was the ones that did all the bookkeeping for this stuff.
Okay.
And like I said, the national banknotes that I was interested in were phased out in 1935. But so what they did is they turned over all their ledgers that they filled out that showed the issuances to the banks of these things to the National Archives. And so the National Archives ended up with something like 400 feet, linear feet, of ledgers that measure about, they're about a foot and a half or 2 feet high by 3 feet long.
Whoa.
The huge things. They got 450 feet of these things, and it has an entire record of all of them that were issued in the entire country.
Wow.
And there were 14,320 banks that issued these things. And they've got all of them, so we know the serial numbers that they issued, so we can tell the rarity of them and all that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
And those were the records that I used to mine. And, of course, I was doing other kinds of research on these things, but that was the core. But when I first went there,
yeah,
they had these things downtown in the old archives building that's down there. You can go to that building to see the Constitution and things like that.
Mm.
But anyway, they moved them out to College Park when they built a new facility. But in the old days, they were stored in the lower reaches of this this old archives building downtown. And that was my first introduction to this stuff. And walking into that place was like a kid walking into a candy store. It was just fantastic. And there was no end to it. I could see that there was no end to it. Once I got involved in that, then it was only a short step before I started visiting the Bureau of Engraving and Printing and getting into their historical records. And then beyond that, it really got interesting. The Bureau of Engraving and Printing, of course, printed this currency. And one thing that they do with the Bureau is when they make a printing plate, they run a proof of it. That's a perfect copy of it.
Okay.
And the director looks at that copy and signs off on the bottom that it's suitable for production use. In other words, it's perfect.
Wow.
So those are called certified proofs. And they started making them in 1863 when they first started taking over printing currency for the country,
okay,
and they've kept all of them.
Wow.
So by the time I was on the scene, they had accumulated something like 270,000 of these proofs.
Wow.
And they're printing proofs, currency, bonds, and anything they make, checks, things like that. And about 50,000 of these things, actually 42,000 of these things, were the large-size national banknotes that I was interested in.
Okay.
And nobody had really seen them before.
Wow.
So
wow.
I learned of these things. They were, the Bureau ran out of room, the storm, so they gave them to the Smithsonian. And they ended up in the Smithsonian Division of Numismatics collection. And I went over there, and pretty soon I wormed my way into that place. And they had a very wonderful opportunity for me. When the things were delivered from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to the Smithsonian, they got all mixed up, so they couldn't find their way around through them. So my wife and I volunteered to sort them for them.
Whoa.
And so I got to see them, the first guy that ever got to see all of them, sorted all 42,000 of them. It took us a couple of years to do it over. We do it a couple of weeks a year, you know.
Wow.
And stuff like that. And then
So hang on a second. Let me just get some details here. When was the first time you went to D.C. to look at the archives?
Oh, it's about 66 or 67.
Okay. And then this journey into the Smithsonian with the bank with all these proofs. When did that relationship start?
Well, that was probably in the late 70s.
Okay.
Or maybe early 80s.
Okay.
It took a while to get going on that.
To develop that relationship.
Yeah.
And so they had the material, but basically they had no finding aid. They hadn't looked at what they had. They just said, "Well, we have a whole bunch of boxes in the corner here."
Yeah, they had it. They had the stuff there. they had a manifest from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, but it was just about useless, you know. That was in order, but the proofs weren't in order. And, well, the fun part was they had a vault, you know, and you go in a vault, and I worked, the vault had numerous shelves. Like I say, they had 270,000 of these. And I was looking at the first 42,000. So, you know, I was just looking at one row of shelves, and there were numerous shelves.
Huh.
And one day, there was a fellow named Jim, I got to think this place. Anyway, the curator of the thing who was giving me access to this stuff was real excited to get these national banknotes organized. So we worked through that. One day we were walking out of the safe and the job was done. And I looked at him, you know, with this nice smile and said, "It's done." And, you know, he was tickled. And as we were walking towards the door of the vault, he stopped me and he said, "Well, what about the rest?" You know, there's 230,000 left, you know.
And you had done the 42,000 large size.
Yeah.
And thought, okay, well, you know, kind of wiping your hands together, you know, dusting your hands off, going, "Well, that's that."
Yeah, we're done. Well, anyway, he says, "What about the rest?" Well, it took me and my wife another 10 years to do the rest.
Wow.
So, you know, I got to see everything. Well, in the process, what this works out to being is a tremendous opportunity. Now, I'm already writing about this stuff, and now what I'm in is the absolute mother load of it.
Oh,
I'm seeing
wow.
stuff that people have never seen before, so I've been able to write articles about this stuff that discusses these in a way and a depth that nobody ever had a chance to do.
Wow.
And so this was a great opportunity. So that's how these people at the National Archives got to know me, because I'd be working at the Smithsonian, find something, have to go over to the archives to research when it was printed and how it happened and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, they have written records, correspondence from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to the various entities that they have to interact with. And these letters explain why there are varieties and why this happened and why that happened. And pretty soon you're really finding really great stuff, let me tell you.
And so you were able to then sort of correlate and tie different collections together.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, it was just like university research.
Yeah.
It was the same thing. And you know, my science research prepared me for this kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's a great symbiotic relationship with this stuff.
Did you get a degree with that, or is it was it just something that you built this way, and you know, now your relationship and your expertise would be worldwide known?
Yeah, well, I got well known in a thing, but I never got a degree, and people have often asked me why I didn't get a degree in history or something that would have allowed me to do this, but this was a sideline, and what it was just a way to have two lives at once. I did the stuff, and I did the geology and the hydrology, mm-hmm. and you know, it was a nice two very different types of things, but you know, you use the same techniques to examine both, and
yeah.
So that's what happened. Mm-hmm. It was just a sideline. Of course, the other thing it did, it allowed me to collect this stuff, and that was good for me.
Right, I can imagine, and what's really neat about this is it sounds like the people that saw you putting in the sweat equity didn't care that you didn't have a degree, history degree or
you know, experience is everything in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you one fun anecdote.
Please.
This happened really early. There was a fellow named Chuck O'Donnell who was writing a catalog on the small size paper money that was issued by the United States. And this is back in 1966 or 68, something like that. I think it was 68. And he invited me to go to Washington with him.
Hmm.
Well, that was my very first trip to Washington to see, you know, to see the repository for these records.
Okay.
And what he had was he had an arrangement with the production manager at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to go through that guy's files, which had plate cards that were the plate histories for every small size U.S. currency plate, and Chuck would simply pull those cards out and total up the number of sheets that were printed in order to get an estimate of rarity for these things.
Oh, wow.
So he invited me to go in there. Well, anyway, I go in with him, and this guy, the production manager, let's see, his name was Morton. I'll think of it. I'm terrible with names sometimes.
No worries.
Anyway, we go in this guy's office, and he has a large office. It's about 15 by 20 feet, and he had a desk that was back by the windows, and he sat between the desk and the window, and he had this stick chair that was in front of the desk, and anybody that came in sat in that stick chair and looked at him with the sun in her eyes.
Oh, great.
It was a real power thing. You know, it was really great the way it was laid out. And the office was spare. That's all of that. On the left side of this guy is this file cabinet with a little table next to it and another stick chair, and that's where Chuck sat. And then next to the door, which faced this guy, was a third stick chair, and I sat down in that because that was the only other thing in the room. And there I was, sitting there very conspicuous with nothing to do for a couple of hours. And finally, this guy looked up at me and he said, "Hey, why don't you go in that door to the right over here, over to my left, and you'll find some stuff that maybe you'll find of interest." And I thought, wow, okay. So I went over and I opened this door. And what it was a hallway about 20 feet long, 20 or 30 feet long, and it was against the windows, the same ones that he was against,
okay,
but hidden from him by the door. And on the right side was a row of file cabinets that were about waist high, a little higher than that, chest high. And I pulled out a drawer, and what I was looking at were production proofs they'd pulled off the line. And these things dated back into the 1800s.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, this was an unbelievable thing for anybody to see, you know, and here I was. I closed the door behind me, and I was in that thing by myself. And I spent the afternoon going through those drawers. Well, I got to one drawer. It was about in the middle. And I pulled it out. And what I'm looking at is a sheet of 12 $100,000 gold notes. Now, this is what these were in 1934 when we went off the gold standard. They printed these gold notes for internal use by the Federal Reserve banks and the Treasury. They used these to back the Federal Reserve notes.
Okay.
And these were beautiful things. They looked like a regular bill, except they were for $100,000, and they had Wilson as the portrait on them. But the neat thing about this series of notes was the backs were gold, not green. Well, I'd seen pictures of these things, obviously, and there I was looking at the live thing, and here was a sheet of them, one sheet sitting in this drawer.
Wow.
So I started to pull it out. You know, that's $1,000,002, right? I start to pull this thing out, and it's stuck. And I'm thinking, oh, Christ, I don't want to be the guy that rips
to
the corner
rip it
off this thing. You know, I figured the corner was stuck under some sheet metal flaw in the drawer or something like that. So I reached in the drawer to feel what was going on so I could get this thing out. And what was holding the thing in place was a block that was sitting on top of the sheet. So, of course, I gingerly pulled the block out to get the sheet out. Well, when I pulled the block out, what I'm holding in my hand is a pack of 100 of these things.
Holy cow!
Yeah, they kept 100 of them, and they had clearly made them as samples because the serial numbers alternated between all zeros and one. So they, you know, there was 50 number one notes and 50 all zero notes. But anyway, here I am, the first trip to Washington, sitting here in a PV, nobody's watching me, and I got $11,200,000 in face sitting in my hand. It was absolutely a fun thing.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
You know, they had a band around the bills, just like they put a band around the $1 bills you get at a bank. And the band was $10 million.
Wow.
Yeah, the sad thing about that was, I wrote articles about that stuff years later, and that was in 68. And about 10 or 12 years later, the Treasury wanted to get those things all redeemed, so they required everybody that had them to send them in, and the Bureau sent those in, and they all got destroyed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's sad.
Did you get a chance to, like take a picture of them before they were destroyed?
Well, the Smithsonian got a couple, so we got pictures of them, but I didn't know. I didn't have a picture of them.
Wow.
And if you ever go to a coin show, sometimes they trot out a sheet of those things that they did save.
Hmm.
It's all punch-canceled, Matt, but at least you can see what they look like.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Wow. I mean, did you go back to Chuck and say, Chuck, you never know what happened to me this afternoon while you were working on this. I was in there.
Well, he knew what was going on. He'd been through some of that stuff.
Oh, wow.
But that was a treasure chest.
Very cool. And
yeah,
you would have been in your mid-20s at that point?
Yeah, yeah. The fellow who it was Morton Rice. That was the guy's name that we visited.
Okay.
Morton C. Rice. Yeah, he was a real nice guy.
Huh.
Yeah, I've subsequently been back to the PEP, and the last time I was there, I was interested in the serial numbering machine they have, which is the size of a tractor trailer. They're absolutely immense machines.
Huh.
And they took me down to the press room where that was running, and I got to sit and watch it for about a half an hour and figure out how it worked.
Wow.
And that was good stuff. That was pretty, you know, it's a very interesting hobby, but it's just like this geology stuff. Once you start getting into it, you just keep peeling the layers of the onion back, and it just gets more and more interesting as time goes on.
Well, I bet. And it sounds like it needed, I mean, you were sort of the right person at the right time to, one, have the interest, and two, have the willingness to help sort this stuff out as it was sort of skeltered, you know, different places here and there. Different people had different pieces of the puzzle.
Well, you know what it is. It's just like the work we did in the Grand Canyon. These opportunities come along, and the big determinant is just to say yes.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Yeah, I'll look, and all of a sudden the door opens.
Hmm.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And then stuff comes to you. Just because you're willing to say yes.
Well, and you've done your research, and so when somebody says, well, you know, what do you know about so-and-so, you can at least say, well, I know a little bit about it, blah, blah.
Yeah, and you got to be receptive to say, yeah, what do you got to offer? What can we collaborate on here, you know?
Or, right, right.
Yeah, what's in it for me? I want to learn more, too, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's the deal. And, you know, a lot of people are a little hesitant to do that. But you get around, you know, in the Grand Canyon research, you know, I rubbed shoulders with the great guys, you know, like Edmund McKee, all these oldesters, you know, they'd come to the museum, you talk to them, and they're excited, they want to tell you about their work.
Yes.
And that gets you going.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like George Billingsley, he met McKee, the next thing is McKee's field assistant out there. Every time McKee would come to the canyon, he'd take George down the canyon. What better education could you get on a stratigraphy of the Grand Canyon?
Absolutely.
You know, and it's the deal of just being willing to say, yeah, I got time to give you. What are we going to do? What are you going to teach me?
Right, right. And that's what you were doing in D.C.
Yeah, and, you know, that's been my life.
Lovely.
Well, yeah, that's a little bit of that story.
Yeah. You got any other stories like that about that time, you know, there in Washington, D.C.? Where did you stay when you were out there?
Oh, well, I used to, you know, I was trying to stay cheap because we were down there for several days at a time.
Right.
I used to stay at an old hotel called the Harrington Hotel at 11th and E Street. And this is right downtown. It was perfect for getting to the Smithsonian and the old archives building.
Okay.
But it was an old 100-year-old hotel, and every time we went there, I wondered if this thing was going to burn down while we were there. That was a real risk. But it's still going.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And would you drive out with Sue, or did you fly out?
Well, we did both. You know, early on, I used to drive that trip, and then later on, I would, you know, just go fly into PWI and go down there.
Okay.
We'd stay for a week or 10 days.
Okay. All right. And I imagine it'd take you 3 or 4 days, maybe 5, to drive across the country to get there. That would have been a long drive.
Well, yeah, but if I did that, you know, I'd stop and see my buddies along the way. You know, my paper money buddies, you know, they were scattered across the country and just dropping in on them. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. Or I'd go to a convention on the way or something like that, you know.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. One anecdote about working in the Smithsonian, when we were sorting the proofs, of course, what we were doing, we were handling these printed objects.
Okay.
And when you handle them for 8 hours a day, ink rubs off. And
So this was before gloves. You go miss that stuff. They give you little white gloves. You put them on, and they don't fit your hand, and you do what you can.
Yeah, well, I wasn't using gloves.
Okay.
Because they were impediment, but... What we had to do is stop every 3 hours and wash our hands because our hands were absolutely black.
Wow.
And you didn't want to fingerprint them. That's how much of this material was going through our hands. It was unbelievable.
Huh.
Yeah. You know, they don't rub off much ink, but after you handle a couple of thousand of them, you got ink on your fingers.
And what were you doing? You were just trying to catalog the serial numbers that they had?
No, just get them in order.
Okay.
You know, but just get them in some order that somebody could find.
Okay.
And then once we got them in order, then we could write a finding aid for them.
And you did that?
Yeah, we did that.
Okay.
And then we did the same thing at the archives. The archives had all these ledgers I was telling you about, and they arrived totally disorganized. Nobody ever straightened them out. And I got a team of guys together, and we went in there. And with archive staff and my team, we sorted those out over a couple of days. And then wrote their finding aid for them, too.
Nice.
And that took, you know, a few trips and a couple of months, you know.
Who was your team? Who did you bring in on your side that was interested in doing this?
Oh, a couple of collectors.
Okay.
Yeah, guys that lived nearby that could come in and donate a couple of days of time.
Cool. Nice.
Yeah, one of the most interesting guys was a fellow named Lee Loftus. Loftus. He worked for the Department of Treasury, and he was their head finance guy.
Hmm.
And every time you see the Secretary of the Treasury testifying in Congress, Lee is sitting next to him feeding him the facts.
Okay.
And so he was right up there at the top of Treasury, but he became a collector, and he's a number one researcher, too. He's right up there at the top.
Cool.
So, you know, another collaborator. But he helped a lot with the work at the Smithsonian, at the archives. And he's a prime user of the archives. So they know him better now than they know me.
Okay. Okay.
You know, it's just the way things go.
Yeah. Loftus is how you spell his last name?
Let me get it for you. It's Loftus.
Okay.
Yeah, he's retired from the Treasury now.
Okay.
Just retired last year.
But I imagine he's still collecting.
Yeah, he's collecting.
Fun. Very fun. We have been visiting here now, not quite 50 minutes. This has been a wonderful journey into an area of which I know absolutely nothing. So it's been great to learn a whole bunch about the treasury and notes and the printing thereof, the manufacture of, the storage of, and wow, thank you for taking the time to talk about this.
Yeah, well, this is a segment you can throw away because it has nothing to do with anything.
Oh, no, sorry, I beg to differ. No, this is very, very fascinating. Awesome. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up part three, and next time we will wander through the stone canyons of a different city, way out west, instead of the stone canyons of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right. Well, with that, let's conclude part three of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Thursday, September 28th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Peter Huntoon, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so very, very much.
Okay. Now, are you getting what you want here?